Good evening, everybody. My name is Jeff Malkolk.
What up, Jeff?
We're grateful to be here. I want to thank Mike for asking me to come up here. I haven't been at this podium in a long time. I was just trying to think on the way here when the last time I stood up here, and it was quite some time ago. I bet you it was almost 10 years ago. This used to be my home group. Still kind of is, I guess. As Tyler was saying, I'm kind of in transition. But I would still consider this my home group. It's been my home group. Let me just put it this way. My love for this group hasn't changed since August 29th of 2007, which happens to be my sobriety date. Actually, to correct that, August 29th of 2007 is my sobriety date, but I walked into this group that following Monday, which probably would have been Labor Day. I don't know what day it was. Maybe it was September 1st. I don't know, September 2nd, something like that. I really don't know. Probably September 1st. But I can remember meeting my sponsor on a Saturday and didn't know I was going to meet him that night. Matter of fact, I didn't really even want to be at that meeting. It was actually right over there at the old spot where this meeting used to be in 2006. And they had moved to this church because there was some kind of political thing going on at that church over there in New Jerusalem, right in New Jerusalem. And so after all the politics, they moved here, and after all the politics got resolved, that church wanted them back. They wanted to have another meeting there. So they started a Saturday night meeting there. And the format was that you would come up and talk about, I think it was three steps. And you brought two people with you, and they would also kind of share in those steps. And something like that. I was pretty, was a little uneven keel at the time. Let's just say that. I was like 3 or 4 days sober, 2 days sober. And one of my friends who I had grown up with showed up at a meeting my second night back in, and probably would have been August 30th. And he saw me and was like, he was excited. Like, I mean, you know, I was going to meetings around my house in down along the Delaware River Valley there. And I'd been going to meetings off and on since 2001. But I had come back in 2007, and this dude was there, and he was like on fire, which I would know that. Then I was just like, oh my God, is this guy ever going to stop talking to me? Like, he was just going, bah, 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 like, with this excitement, this enthusiasm, and he had one of those little blue books, those little ones, and he was just like, oh, da, 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 and steps and this and that, and then it's going on and on and on, and he's like, oh my God, you gotta come to this meeting Saturday night, my sponsor's talking there, he's from out in New York, and I'm living out in New York, you gotta come to this meeting. He was back visiting his relatives for the weekend, and I'm like, I don't know, dude, I'm like, where's this meeting at? And he's like, it's in Perkasie, or Sellersville, and I'm like, I'm a Jersey guy. I'm like, where the heck is Sellersville? And he's like, oh, it's like 40 minutes west of here, out by Perkasie, out by Quakertown. And I'm like, 40 minutes, dude? Really? You want to drive 40 minutes to a meeting? Like, at that time, I had this idea that AA was like, okay, I find like 7 meetings within 5 minutes of my house, and that's like my AA life. And at the time, I was like, that's my AA life the rest of my life. And I was like, huh. That didn't really seem too hopeful to me, but at that time, I was had been in and out, and I was like, okay, what else do I got? And then he said 40 minutes, and I'm like, oh my God, that seemed a little excessive. But he wouldn't take no for an answer. I'm very thankful for that guy. You know, I should probably call him tomorrow and thank him. I don't know if he's sober anymore, but I think he saved my life that night. Excuse me, Mr. Bugney. So he brought me to this meeting. He annoyed me into going to this meeting. I didn't really want to be there, but I was like, okay, I'll go if you don't talk the whole time. If you're going to talk in the car the whole way, I ain't going. So he promised me he wouldn't talk the whole time. But he lied. He talked the whole time. You know, all about God and his steps and helping others. And I had no idea what that was about at the time. I was going to like meetings that they just weren't talking about that. I'm not going to say those meetings were bad or wrong. Just at the time, they weren't stressing that like this dude was. And I walked into that meeting, and I didn't know anybody except for that guy I came with. And, this guy got up to the podium to speak, and this message blew me away. It's this guy named Ben, not New York, Ben D. We'll leave it at that. And his message was incredible. He talked about the Big Book in a way that I've never heard anybody share about the Big Book. I mean, I've been to Big Book meetings where they read and they're like, well, this is how this affects me today. And this guy was like, this is what this book did to my life. And he's like, my life is so incredibly different that my father, who's not an alcoholic, went out and bought a Big Book just so he could read it to know what happened to his kid. He's like saying this from the podium. I'm like, that's pretty impressive stuff, man. Like, you know, it's like, I had never really heard like that kind of talk before. And after the meeting, I saw this guy walking around. Just walking around, nice and slow. And he had this vibe. I don't know if you get vibes from people when you see him, but he had this vibe that was just like exuded peace and serenity. And like people would come up to talk to him. I noticed a lot of people wanted to talk to him. He was like, he would stop what he was doing and actually like stop and look at them and listen to them. And after the meeting, my buddy's like, you should go talk to that guy. I'm like, I'm not going to go talk to that guy. I don't even know that guy. He's like, you should go talk to that guy. I'm like, I'm not. I don't know that dude. I'm not talking to that guy, man. I'm not going to walk up to some guy I don't know and talk to him. And he's like, no, Tony, you should go talk to that guy. I can help you. He can help you, man. Go talk to him. I'm like, all right, dude, I'll go. Just shut up. Stop talking. And I walked into the kitchen, and they were, this guy was washing cups because they were still using actual coffee cups. 2007 over there, because they didn't have enough money. They didn't have enough money to buy. The meeting was so new, they didn't have enough money to buy styrofoam cups. And he stopped what he was doing. I said, hey, can you help me? He stopped washing cups, and he looked at me, and he was like, yeah, what's up? Can I help you? And I proceeded to tell him what was going on in my life, which was that I'd been in and out of AA, and I hated my life, and I couldn't stand it, and I couldn't stop drinking, and I lost everything, and I couldn't deal with life anymore the way it was. It just looked too, like I was ready to kill people. Like I was literally ready to like just off myself and take a bunch of people with me. That's really how I felt at the time. And he's like, okay. And he stopped. And then he said something to me about his alcoholism. And he said something in a way that touched me that I was like, oh my God, this guy knows. Like, I immediately identified with what he said about how he used to be. Like, he wasn't like, find God, God's great. He wasn't like that. He was like, well, let me tell you about what happened to me. And he said this, like, brief little qualification that he was so good at, you know, he was able to get a point across in very few words. And I was like, oh my God, this guy knows. He knows what I'm going through right now. And it was clear to me watching him walk around that he was not like that anymore. Like, he did not feel like I was feeling. And that was the theme that went throughout my life, seeing people and being like, how come I don't feel like they look? You know, went through school, my family, everything. But anyway, back to the story. So I'm like, well, dude, can you help me? Do you think you could help me? And he looks at me and he says, well, listen, he's like, you're from York. You came with those guys from York because I came with the guy from York. Even though he wasn't from York at that time, he was visiting his parents, but I came with him, and he's like, he thought I was from York, and I was like, dude, I'm not from York. And he's like, well, where do you live? I said, well, you ever hear this little town called Regalsville? And he looked me in the eye, and he was like, Jeff, I live in Regalsville. Literally, he lived 2 miles from my house. And I stand up here today, 15 years later, and I think to myself, if that guy who brought me to that meeting didn't do what he did, I may not be standing here tonight. I may not even have 15 years sober. You know, my grand sponsor used to talk about seconds and inches, how quick, how just a one little change in what we do and how, and the decisions we make change our course of our life forever. That was one of them. This guy Greg became my sponsor. Told me that, he asked me if I read the big book, and I told him no. And he's like, "Well, you're gonna now." He said, "Because we're gonna go through the steps out of the book, and we need to be reading the same damn book. So we're gonna read out of that book. So I want you to go home. I want you to read the doctor's opinion, and we agnostics. I want you to call me tomorrow." And I did that. I went home and I read it. And he said, I called him and he said, "All right, meet me at my house tonight. We're going to a meeting at the hospital over in Sellersville." And they used to have the Saturday night meeting there. And Sunday night meeting. It was the next day. And I walked in there and there was a guy up at the podium. And there was a guy sitting with him who had like 6 months at the time. And the guy at the podium, I don't even know how long he had at the time. I couldn't have told you that. But I walked into that meeting and I listened to that guy share. And I just watched that guy, other guy chair the meeting. And, you know, that guy who I met Sunday became one of my best friends, Nick. Recently passed away. Some of you might know him, Tree. Seconds and inches, man. I spent every summer with Tree up in Maine for the next 13 years until he couldn't go anymore because he had cancer. We traveled all over. He literally was one of my most famous people, or most favorite people in AA. And so that night, as I'm getting out of the car, after I met Tree and those guys, and I didn't know any of that was going to happen, I just knew I met this new guy. And I was with my now sponsor. And I remember walking in, I'm like, "So, and the whole way out, he's talking about the first step, you know, about powerlessness. He's talking about the doctor's opinion. I didn't know that, really. He was paraphrasing a lot of it because he was very good at that. And I remember walking into the meeting at the hospital being like, "So, Greg, so, you know, so, will you sponsor me?" And I remember stopping and looking at me with this look that he always had. He was like, "I am your sponsor." And I'm like, "Does that mean I got to call you every day?" And he stopped. And he goes, "Jeff, if you call me every day, I will not be your sponsor." And he was right. He worked with so many guys. If every person that Greg was working with at that time called him, he would not be able to do what he needed to do throughout his day. And he was always like, "Listen, don't call me. I want you to say, go say a prayer. Ask God. Ask God to help you. Ask God what you need to do before you call me. Don't be calling me first." It's like, you need to be asking somebody who's got the power, and I don't have the power. It's like, I have feet of clay. I'll fail you. My job is just to show you what I was shown, and that's it. And then put your hand in God's hand, and then you go on and do your thing. He's like, "I'll be with you. I'll walk with you." He's like, "But I am neither in front of you nor behind you. I am with you." And he was very much like that. So that night, getting out of the car, he said, "Listen, tomorrow night, I want you to be at this meeting. It's at 2501 Allentown Road, Quakertown, New Jersey, West Swamp Mennonite Church. Be there tomorrow, 7:30. It's like, God, another meeting is 40 minutes away from my house. Jesus. Like, doesn't this guy go to any meetings locally to me? So it's like, I said what a good, desperate alcoholic says when they don't have any other choices. Okay. Okay. And I pulled in here that next Monday. And there was people sitting like they are now. People had blankets. There was kids playing on the playground out there. And I remember thinking to myself, I think I'm in the wrong place, man. I'm like, I don't think this is an AA meeting. This looks like a church picnic. Like, it looked, people were like way too happy for AA. I mean, that didn't seem like something that was like an AA meeting that I ever been to. Outside, people were running around, little kids, they had dogs, people sitting in the grass. I was like, this is like, I'm like, is this even an AA meeting? You know? And it was, you know, Greg was here, and he introduced me to the speaker that night. His name was Ante. If anybody, if you know Ante, he just spoke here not so long ago. And we all went out to dinner afterwards after that meeting that night. After Ante spoke, we went out to dinner. That used to be a tradition here. We used to go down to John's Point of Fancy. There'd be, you know, 15, 20 of us down there. And I remember afterwards, Greg was like, get his number, get his number, get his number, get his number. Call him. And I can remember the next day, I had some health issues coming in here, and I had some tests that I was taking. And I didn't know the results of those tests yet. And I remember calling Ante. I had never met him before. He spoke from this podium. I totally identified with him. I met him for, like, realistically, like, talked to him for 5 minutes outside the diner. He gave me his phone number, and I called him the next day because I was terrified. You know, my mind was going. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. But my mind was going. Like, the wall of TVs at Best Buy, all different channels, all full blast, all yelling at me once. And main thing was this test, this medical test that was going to be pretty, you know, if it went one way, it could be pretty bad for me. And I was terrified of the outcome. And I was like obsessed over it. I couldn't get it out of my head. I couldn't even like, I couldn't function because I was still had that obsession of like just thinking about things over and over and over and over and over and over again. And somebody's like, okay, stop thinking about it. And I'd be like, oh, think about this. And I would start thinking about that. And somehow I'd be like, oh yeah, well, the medical thing. And I'd be like, back to it. I called this guy Ante. Again, I met him like 5 minutes. Didn't really know him at all. And I swear to God, he took like 40 minutes out of his day to talk to me that day on the phone. And that meant the world to me at that time. That he took that amount of time of his precious moments of his life he could never get back. And he spent them on me. This was like within 4 days of getting sober this last time. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this is because I've been in AA since 2001. Right? And I've had a lot in that time. I couldn't stay sober for more than like 90 days at a shot. But I tried. And in that time, I've had tons in New Jersey. We take these little meeting lists, and when there's a new person at a meeting, everybody writes their name on the back of the thing, and they hand them out, and they get everybody's name on it, and then they give it to you, and they say, hey, here's a list of phone numbers. Call some of these people. And I never did. I never did it. I'm not saying that's wrong or that's not right. But what happened here was a connection beyond, like, just giving somebody their number and saying, here, give me a call sometime. These dudes, like, they wanted, like, I knew they were going out of their way to try to help me. Like, they were, like, doing things that I hadn't seen people do in other meetings around me at that time. And, consequently, after I'd been through the steps with Greg, you know, that's what he implored me to do. Was to be useful to others in AA. That's why you're here. The only reason you're here is to help others. I remember he used to tell me, help others or die. He's like, they're your choices. He said, because if you don't help others, that's what the steps are telling us to do, ultimately. Live by these principles and help other alcoholics. He said, if you don't do that, he said, you're probably going to go back to your old ways. He said, if you go back to your old ways, you're going to drink, and if you drink, you're going to die. If you're alcoholic, that's what's going to happen. And I believed him. I really did. I really thought that alcohol was going to kill me. So that's what he implored me to do, and again, this group's been extremely dear to my heart because of that. I had never experienced AA like I started to experience AA through the experiences of these guys, through these guys just grabbing me up and being like, hey, this is where we're going tonight, come on, meet me at my house. And we'd go to Philly, and we'd go to down into Delaware, and they would travel all over speaking, and they introduced me to guys coming here, and women speaking here, that were coming from all over, from York, from White Rose Group at the time, and it became this, like, this energy in my life. AA became this energy, became this power. And, you know, whether it's, you want to be synonymous with God, power, energy, spirit, whatever, it's all the same. But I started to experience that power, that energy, that spirit, that, like, waking up in the morning and being like, all right, I wonder where everybody's going tonight. You know, I wonder if I'm going to go to a meeting tonight and meet somebody at a meeting that needs help, and then maybe they're going to call me tomorrow. You know? And, it was just awesome. It was awesome. I am an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was when I got here. I thought that an alcoholic meant that I raised my hand and said, I'm alcoholic, therefore I am. I still didn't know what actually defined one as per AA's vision of what an alcoholic is, which is pretty much outlined in the big book in The Doctor's Opinion, what Silkworth wrote back all those years ago. You know, and my sponsor, I remember him qualifying me real simply. He wasn't like, give me the pamphlet with the 20 questions or the 40 questions, whatever it's up to now. But he said, listen, Jeff, he said, when you take a drink, do you know with any certainty when you're going to stop? And I said to him, I was like, I thought I was being real cool. I was like, well, sometimes I can. And he said, well, that's not really certain, is it? And I'm like, he said, I said, with any certainty, do you know? And I said, well, no, not really. I don't know what it is. Usually I start drinking and I never know what's going to happen. I could then start drinking and end up in freaking Pittsburgh, wake up in a hotel with a bunch of people I don't know in the morning. That's happened to me. I mean, you know, I don't know what's going to happen once I take that first drink. And he said, okay, so once you start drinking, you don't have any power over that drink. Once you start, you can't stop. He said, now I'm going to ask you another question. He said, when you're stopped and you don't want to drink anymore, can you on your own not drink? And that was easy. I was like, well, clearly no. I mean, I'm here talking to you. I'm in an AA meeting. Clearly, if I could just not drink, I would be out not drinking and my life would be better than it is. And he said, okay, so when you're stopped, you can't stay stopped on your own. He said, Jeff, that is called the mental obsession. And he said, and the inability to stop once you start is called the phenomenon of craving. And he said, the physical and the mental are where you're always at. He said, there's no door number three. You're either taking a drink, getting drunk, or you're not drinking, thinking about a drink, which then ultimately leads you to take a drink, let's get you drunk again. And he said, you're either in one of those two places. And he said, either one of those two places, you, on your own, cannot solve problems in your life. And he said, what happens is the problems pile up. And he said, your ability to deal with your problems goes down. And he said, your life shifts completely out of balance as a result of that powerlessness in the mental and the physical. And he said, that shift, that inability to solve problems in your life, that you need to do every day, whether it's with your family, relationships, at work, driving down the road, at the supermarket, whatever, he said, that inability to solve problems is called unmanageability. And the book puts it, you know, I didn't realize he was paraphrasing until much later. I've been through the book a bunch of times. You know, it says the problems pile up upon an alcoholic and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That's the way Dr. Silkworth puts it. The problems pile up, become astonishingly difficult to solve because of the physical allergy and the mental obsession. And I saw that in myself. And nobody ever explained what alcoholism is. He didn't explain it to me in this, like, mental, physical way. I was just like, I drink a lot, I get drunk. That's why I was like, I raise my hand and said I'm alcoholic. Isn't that good enough? He's like, no, you really need to know why you're alcoholic. He said, because the third part of this equation, which is the spiritual part, leads us back to the obsession every time. And he started talking about the spiritual malady, the disconnection, restless irritable discontent. He said, you're restless irritable discontent without a drink. Without a drink, you don't feel good. You don't feel okay. Nothing works out. Nothing feels satisfactory. And he said, that is the spiritual malady. And he said, if you don't solve the spiritual part, he said, your mind will always look to the solution of alcohol, and eventually becomes an obsession. Think about it enough, it becomes an obsession. The obsession becomes so great, pushes out of my mind every horrible thing that alcohol did to me, and all I can think about is what alcohol does for me. He said, you will take a drink, and when you take a drink, you will trigger the allergy, and you will get drunk again. And he said, getting drunk means getting arrested, not showing up for work, crashing your car, not paying your insurance, not paying your registration, all those things that make life look uncomfortable in the morning. And he said, you're going to wake up now with a bunch more problems that you can't solve, and you're going to look at this world and go, God, this sucks. I hate this world. This sucks. I have all these problems. I don't like the way this is happening. This is happening to me. This is not good. How come I feel this way? And then your mind will start to think about, well, you remember the sense of ease and comfort, that comes with a couple drinks? And he said, you can just repeat that over and over and over and over again. There's this guy, Cliff Roach, out in California, and I'm pretty sure he passed away. This was back in the 80s. And he said this one thing one night I was listening to. He's like this old surfer dude from out in California, part of the Pacific group. And I remember he said this one thing one night, and it totally hit me. He said, no matter how bad my drinking got, no matter how bad it was, there was always 8 minutes of pure joy about 40 minutes into my drinking. He said, after that 8 minutes, the rest was crap. You know, it was, I won't use any other words, but it was crap. It's like everything went to hell. You know, all the relationship problems, the job problems, all that came crashing back in. But he said, 40 minutes in, 8 minutes of just pure joy. And that is all my mind, mentally, that's all my mind can think about. If I get that uncomfortable, my mind will think about that 8 minutes, and that will become it. He said, so basically, you need to solve the spiritual part. I looked up the definition of spirit, and basically, I'm going to paraphrase, it is the inanimate or invisible energy or force that drives us or animates our lives. And I refer to it when I talk to sponsees or people, you say, you know, if you remember being in school, at a pep rally, kids had school spirit. And they were like, yeah, 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 yeah. And I'll tell you, when I first came in here, deep in my alcoholism, I was not waking up with that kind of enthusiasm. I was waking up and going, oh my God, kill me now. This sucks. Another day. I got to go through another day here on this planet with all you people that I can't stand. I got to do this again. And in my mind would go, well, you remember that 8 minutes? That felt pretty good. Sense needs to come with comes with a couple of drinks. Now, my brother's not alcoholic. My brother, because alcohol does, you know, a lot of the same things it does to me, it does to other people. You know, my brother is, he's a truck driver. And some days he likes his job, some days he hates it. And he drives around here, Route 80. Sometimes he goes in out in New Jersey towards the city. And I'll tell you, he can come home and be completely angry at his boss, angry at every driver on Route 80, and be completely spiritual disconnected, completely disconnected from that enthusiasm, the energy, like, yeah, everything's great. He can be completely disconnected and be like, okay, everything sucks. Today was the worst day ever. And you know what? He'll go home and he'll sit down at dinner and he'll crack open the beer and he'll drink it. He might even grab a second one during dinner and drink that second one, and he'll get the sense and ease and comfort that comes with a couple of drinks. But you know what he does then? He goes and sits and watches TV, eats some popcorn, and then gets up and goes to work the next day. That does not happen to me. See, I think about that, and I take a couple of drinks, and I'm like, okay, I'm out of here. I got stuff to do, man. And I'm calling people going, okay, what do you got? Where are you going? Where are we going tonight? And then I get there, we start drinking, I'm like, okay, where are we going from here? Oh, we going to Philly, going to Pittsburgh, where do you want to go? Going to the city, going to New York? Let's go, there's after hours closed, man. I'm like, I am out of there. So, for me, he was big on solving the spiritual part. He said, how do we get that spirit, the energy, power back in your life? How do we get you connected to this power? Because that's what has to happen in order for you to stay comfortably sober here, long term. And the reason I know that is because a year later, my sponsor got drunk. I started working with other guys. That's what he told me to do. He took me through the steps. I'm not going to go through all the steps. I think it's a personal thing, but I've been through the work. And, you know, and he was like, help others. And I was in my whole, I was in this, like, helping others thing by, like, I want to say I asked Monty probably about, like, I don't know, 60 days into this thing. I did my inventory. I started doing some amends, and I, like, hooked up with this guy who's still today sober, and it's not because of me. It's because of what he does consistently in his life. But I started working with others, and I was like, my life came alive. I lived down in Holland Township, New Jersey, right along the river, and there was this little halfway house that opened. Like, my sponsor's like, you need to work with others, you gotta go through the steps, take them through the steps. So, like, I lived in this place where there has never been a halfway house this long. I've lived there all my life. Never been a halfway house. Ever. Ever. By that November, there was a halfway house. Within like 3 miles of my house. It was called, don't know why, but it's called Half Measure's House. Go figure. But it opened. And there was just this young group of young guys, this influx of young guys over and over and over coming into this house. Mostly from Sunrise House up in Lafayette. Now, for about two years probably, that house existed there. Maybe a year and a half. And I had just constant guys pick up one guy in my truck, three guys would get in my truck. And we'd come here or go wherever. And I'll tell you, if it wasn't a God thing, if God didn't put that house there, because for me, I don't know why, but that house disappeared. They sold it. Somebody moved in there. Never been a halfway house since. But for that year and a half, it was like the most exciting time of my life. So about a year into this thing, my sponsor, I haven't heard from him in a while. And it was nothing new. Like, he wasn't like a, I'll call him and he'll get right back to you within the hour kind of guy. Like, he'd literally be like, I am Peter Clay, dude. I am not the solution to your problems in your life. You need to bring this to God. You need to go through the steps, form this relationship with this power, and then that becomes where you need to go. And so if you can't get your answer there, and you can't get your answers from guys you're helping, then call me. So when he didn't call me back for a little while, I was like, eh, you know, that's just how great it is sometimes. You know, he's busy. He's a busy guy. And I'll never forget, I was coming home from work. I was coming up over this hill right in Asbury, New Jersey. I still remember the sun going down. And he called, and I was like, I pulled over. I was like, Greg, what's up? And he said, Jeff, so I got to tell you, I'm sitting in a bar drinking right now. And I remember thinking, okay. And I remember, this is what I said to him. I said, Greg, there's nothing you can do that'll make me not love you anymore. Nothing. I said, so doesn't change how I feel about you right now. I love you, and I always will. And if you need help, if you need anything from me, I am here for you. And in the years past, he's gone in and out a few times. He's currently down in Baltimore. And he's currently sober down there doing what he needs to do. And he'll tell you flat out, the reason he got drunk is because he stopped applying these principles in his life. Hands down. And when that happens, he said, the chatter in my head, that spiritual malady comes back. And he said, that uncomfortability becomes so great that, again, the mind starts to think about relief. And nothing in my life before the steps worked as well as alcohol did when I got in that state. Because alcohol changed the way the world looks. I don't know how it worked for you guys, but when I drank, like, I could go into a bar at the end of the day and be like, God, this is horrible. Like, I spent all day working in the hot sun. My life is, why am I even doing this? This is stupid. And I'd go into a bar and I'd be like, yeah, that guy's a jerk. That guy's a jerk. She's probably not going to want to talk to me. She's not going to want to talk to me. That guy's a jerk. And I'll have a couple drinks and suddenly I'm like, oh, he's my new best friend playing pool. You know, I'll walk right up to people and start talking. What happens is alcohol, from the inside out, changes, it alters the way the world looks. It changed it. Literally. From the inside out, I was looking at a new, different world. Now, nothing out there changed, but it looked completely different. And for a long time, alcohol worked flawlessly. Flawlessly. It did that every time I wanted it to. The problem is later is this phenomenon of craving, this allergy started to happen. And I was getting drunk when I didn't want to be. And then this other thing started happening. I started drinking at times I didn't want to start. And I fell into that abyss. This is very, very difficult to get out. If you're a real alcoholic, there is no way out other than find a new way to see the world other than using alcohol. And it was my experience. I wouldn't even say it was told to me. It has been my experience that the steps through doing, making a couple decisions, writing some inventory about the way I see the world and you guys and my relationship to you guys, asking this power to change me, and then going out and trying to change myself and change my behavior, going to people I've harmed with humility and saying, hey, how can I fix this? I hurt you. How can I make it right? And then, you know, continually trying to keep that inventory at the back of my mind of like, when are you hurt people? Did you just say that? Should you not make amends for that? And then going into this meditation and reading things and like deepening this connection, and then ultimately working with others. It changed the way the world looks to me. It changed the way I see you, the way I see the world, and everything in it. Now, I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh, every day's perfect, and I never get mad, I never get angry, and I never get mad at my parents who I work with every day, you know, at the business. Like, I'm not saying that. But for 98% of the time, man, the way the world looks to me is actually comfortable. I suddenly feel like a lot of you guys look. Because I grew up in school and I was looking around and I was like, man, how come I don't feel like these guys? Like, I'd see like kids playing with each other and I'd be like, man, it's like they're just like, they're connected. They have this connection. They're friends. You know, that's what we would call it back then. It's really connection, but they were friends. And they had this thing where they were connected some way. And I was like, God, I wish I had that. Because I always felt alone, so I wish I had that connection. And I'd look at these guys being friends and I'd be like, God, how is that so easy to them? Like, how come I don't feel like they look? I didn't realize today that it is that spiritual malady, that disconnection, that inability to see the world truthfully, really, what it comes down to, which you could call fear. And fear ran my life, you know, and it can today. If I let up on this plan, this action, this plan of action that's laid out here, if I let up on that at all, man, that fear comes crashing back in, whether it's job, relationship, family, anything, finances. About 10 years sober, I had it happen. I had been working with a lot of guys, and I was, you know, hanging out with all my AA peeps, and then life was going good, and I was, you know, just got my 10-year coin, and I had just become involved in Pensy Pa at the time, when it was coming to Allentown, when they were having an Allentown. And I got involved in a relationship. Whether I should have been in a relationship, not important, but I did it. And this relationship with this person became more important than my relationship with people in AA. And it became more important than my relationship with this power. And I started slowly taking that power and giving it to this other person. And I didn't know I was doing it. I kind of equate it to, you know, when you shoot a bullet. And if you're off just like a half a millisecond or millimeter at the muzzle, by the time you project that out, you're like feet off the target. You're not even on the target. And that's what happened to me. I kind of started going down this path. It wasn't the 12 steps. It was this relationship path. And it was just slightly off of what we were doing here. And I kept going. And before you knew it, I felt like I don't think anybody's ever watched Patch Adams. But it felt like when he says it in the beginning of the movie, I was in a dark woods. And I couldn't find my way out. Suddenly I was in the dark again. There was no light. There was no spirit. There was nothing. And the person that I gave all my power to left my life abruptly and would not talk to me anymore. And I was devastated over it. Like I said, it literally left me in this darkest place I'd ever been in my life. I was literally, and at the time, like I said, I was very involved in AA. Still, on some levels, I still was trying to, you know, working with other guys and trying to hit a lot of meetings and going with my good friend Jimmy C. And I was involved in Pensacola at the time. And it got to the point where I was so out of my spiritual connectedness that I was like, I was going to Pensacola. I was like, hey, I got to leave my position. I can't even do this. Like, I can't do this because my mind is so messed up right now. And everyone, all of them were like, no. You need to do this now. You need to keep doing this. And they wouldn't let me resign. They wouldn't let me resign. And my good friend Jimmy, I remember he used to call me. He was calling me all the time. He'd be like, hey, we're going to a meeting tonight. Where are you going to meet me? Like, oh, okay, wherever. And I'd meet him there. We'd be walking in and be like, you know what you're here for, right? Like, what? He'd be like, help others, dude. Help others. That's why you're here. Help others. And I felt like in my heart, I was like, I feel like I wanted to kill myself some mornings. Like, literally, I was like to the point, I didn't want to drink, but I was like, I was just so heartbroken. My heart was just so broken that I was like, I don't even want to do this anymore. And man, these guys just kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me. Like, keep going, keep going, keep going. And eventually, I did some inventory. At that time, my sponsor had been sober for quite some time down in Baltimore. I went down and I did some inventory with him. And about the relationship mostly, about where I lived. I was living with my parents at the time. I thought that was the greatest thing in the world because I had all this freedom. And I remember he wanted me to write. He wanted me to move out. He's like, Jeff, you need to grow up. You need to get out of your parents' house. I was like 40-some years old living with my parents. He's like, you need to get out of your parents' house. You need to move out. And I'm like, I don't know how. Right? I've lived with my parents. I don't know how to do that. He's like, okay, I want you to write inventory about fear around moving out. And I remember I went down there and I wrote, in the fears column about moving out of my house, I was like, I'll lose my freedom. Because in my mind, my twisted alcoholic mind, I was like, well, I live with my parents. I can just leave and come and go and leave as I please. I don't have any real responsibilities. I don't have to like, I'm not like, I'm paying rent working with them, but I don't like have any like electric bill or phone bill or any of this. I felt free. But I felt free. So he goes over this thing. He's like, he's looking at my inventory. He's like, what's this thing? You're going to lose your freedom? I'm like, yeah, you know, if I lose my move out, how am I, you know, I'm going to have like all these responsibilities. And I remember he looked, this is the magic of inventory. He looked me right in the eye and he goes, so Jeff, how free are you now? And I was not free. I was in a prison that I created. I was not free. And I was like, oh, you're right. I'm not free, man. And it just so happened that my grandmother's house, my grandmother where I work, she had passed away a little bit before that, and nobody was living in her house. And right after that, a guy came to me and said, hey, listen, I have a job opportunity for you in the wintertime, which I didn't make a lot of money. I do landscaping. So finances were tough in the winter for me. And he said, I have a job opportunity for you that can make you quite a bit of money in the winter. And I took it. And it gave me enough money to move into that little house my grandmother used to live. And I got free. I didn't know it. I didn't know that was going to happen, but I got free. Never felt freer. I've entered into a relationship with somebody. I never thought that was possible. I struggled with the grass is always greener concept in my life. So no, I can't. I'm not like going to get strapped down to one person because, you know, what if somebody better comes along? You know, there's 7 billion people on the planet. Any one of them could be better than the one I'm with right now. Right? I know, how horribly selfish of me, right? And all that stuff came out in this inventory when I went down with my sponsor. And I kind of had to pull back on the relationship thing. I was a little promiscuous. Let's just put it lightly. I was promiscuous. And I sought some therapy, you know, outside stuff. And that helped me tremendously. But mostly it was this growing up, moving out. I remember my therapist also was, imagine this, my therapist also agreed with my sponsor that I needed to move out and grow up. And not live like a 17-year-old when I was 40. And I remember walking into this this chick, she was awesome. I still love her to this day. And I remember being like, you're never going to guess what? I bought a vacuum. And she's like, I'm proud of you, Jeff. I'm proud of you. You bought a vacuum for your house. She's like, now do you use it? I'm like, yeah, sometimes. Sometimes. Probably not as much as I should. But, so, you know, I found something here. Something was given to me here in AA this time around. Because I've had the prior experiences of just going to meetings. Somebody gave me a big book early on. I didn't read it. I took it and I had it at home. And if you asked me, I said, yeah, I have a big book. It's a third edition, you know. I was proud of that, right? I was like, oh, my third edition big book. Like how cool I am. And but I never read it, man. I never did what it said, that's for sure. I didn't realize that the solution to my problems was the actions I needed to take in that meeting, in that book, which would lead me to this power, this connection, this wholeness, oneness. I remember, you know, when later, I'm a big history buff, and later with when Bill Wilson would write his letters to Carl Jung, and was like, because Carl Jung had no idea that what he did for Roland started this whole chain of events that led to AA. Like, Carl Jung was a big influence in why AA, Seconds and Inches. Why any of us are here. And Bill Wilson was like, oh my God, the one pastor that became a spiritual advisor said, listen, Bill, not only should you go back and make amends to people, but maybe you should go back and actually thank the people that helped you along the way. And that became a big thing with Bill. So he thought he needed to write to Carl Jung and say, you know, I want to thank you for what you did and what you said and did for Roland Hazard. And as a result of that, this whole thing happened, this chain of events, which led me to, you know, led me to Dr. Bob and the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous and 12 Steps and blah, blah, blah. And Carl Jung was like, he wrote back. He's like, well, that's all great. He's like, all I was trying to do is just help change Roland Hazard's perception a little bit so he could see the world differently. Spiritual experience spirit or experience, power, energy. And, he said, you know, alcohol is very close to a spirit. That's why they call us alcohol spirits. Right? You watch people drink, man. Magic happens when people drink. I'm talking about whether alcoholic or non-alcoholic. People start drinking, they're like, woo! Yeah! Like, they become that kid in the pep rally filled with spirit. So when the 12 steps talk about spiritual experience, or a spiritual awakening, an awakened spirit. And what does that look like? Enthusiasm, energy, power. So I was given that gift here. And again, I had to do some things for that to happen. And I had to become willing to do those things. And I had to meet the right people that were able to helped me identify within myself the real problem. And it was critical for me. I'm going to end with this. I'm going to read something real quick. This is out of a book called hold on. I'm drawing a blank. Whatever, I'll tell you after because it'll come to me. It's written by Ernie Kirst, who's one of us. Spirituality and Imperfection, that's the name of the book. Long before his first meeting with Bill Wilson, the meeting that has been referred to as the founding moment of Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith joined the Oxford group in the hope of finding, quote, a cure for his alcoholism. It didn't work. He went to the meetings, read the books, sought and practiced guidance by seeking directions from both God and other group members, and consistently went home and got drunk again. Then in November of 1934, Bill Wilson had his last drink. And in May 1935, he happened into Bill Bob Smith's life. On that Sunday evening, as the two men alternately sat and paced
for more than 5 hours in the library of Henrietta Stoddard-Link's residence in Akron, Ohio, something was added to the Oxford Group message. The identification that sprang from their listening to each other helped both Bill Wilson and Dr. Robert Smith to the understanding, the vision, that the purpose of life wasn't to get, but to give. For only when you give do you get. The religious right of the Oxford Group had afforded only a kind of monologue. Many people spoke, but few of them ever listened or seemed to ever listen. In their first meeting with each other, Bill W. and Dr. Bob did listen, avidly. And in that listening, both came to the realization that what they needed was a dialogue, and that in their shared alcoholism, on the basis of their common imperfection, they found it. Years later, Dr. Bob explained in liquid terms, singularly appropriate for an alcoholic, the most profound message he had learned from Bill Wilson. The spiritual approach was as useless as any other if you soaked it up like a sponge and kept it to yourself. So the whole point of this is to give it away. When you get free, help others get free. That was Bill's vision, and that's what we still do today. And I am very grateful for all those who helped me get free. And to make it up to them, to repay them, I try to help others get free on a consistent basis. And my life's never been the same since. So I just want to thank all you guys for having me. Thank Mike for asking me to speak. And I'm just really grateful to be here. Thanks.